Succession number 10413, rule 19.
Mr. George Self, Reel 19. We were talking about the 1944 campaign. Mm-hmm. Was there much looting to speak of from either Germans or from what the French and Belgians had left behind?
Well, from the Germans, the first thing when you took a prisoner, not that there was very good someone, but a lot of people did that. And looting, I suppose, there was looting on a small scale. I didn't do much myself because it was getting it out of the country. And I used to see people looting in one house. And by they got a bit further along the road, they'd be throwing it away and getting something else. And to me, it wasn't worth it. And besides, you weren't looting off the enemy, you were looting off your so-called friends. And I saw no point in it. Not that I'm saying that. I was one of the good boys. I did as much damage as anybody else, but to me it wasn't worth it. If you were caught, it was a court-martial. I suppose some of the boys got some things on, souvenirs, but that's all.
You mentioned, we were talking about booby traps earlier. Were people very careful in collecting souvenirs? I mean,
oh, yes. I mean, if you went into a house, it's the first thing you look for. Because the Germans, if they'd been billeted there or they'd used the house, they would booby trap it before they left. And so that was the first thing you look for. If it was occupied by the people that lived there, you used to find a lot of people down in the cellars, because they all had basement cellars. In the latter part of our campaign, anyhow, you used to find people down there. And everybody, you know, look for these things, because it's too late to just barge in and not take notice, because that's when you got the knock. So you were alert all the time. You had to be, anyhow, if you wanted to survive.
Now, you told me in the preliminary, you told me about a young lad who was killed. I think it was by a spring bomb or an S-bomb.
S-bomb.
Could you tell me that story? Because that well, combines a few of these themes.
We were in a rest area, and there was time to spare. You could either get your head down, play cards or anything like that. And these three young lads decided they would go for a wander around, see what they could find. And walking up to this chateau, one of them stood on an S-mine, I suppose. Because they were in a rear area, they dropped the defences, and they walked on this S-mine. And it killed this young boy, blew the leg off another one, and the other one was very badly wounded. And the next thing we knew, we received the papers from back home, and this young boy that was killed was only 16 years old. And his parents were making a song and dance about him being in the front line at 16 year old. And I was doing platoon commanding. As I say, I went to his parents, saying he'd been killed in action. And I also told them that it was too late to shout about this 16, that they should have shouted when he joined the forces. He must have joined under a false age. I never had no reply, but it was an unfortunate thing. They dropped the defences, and these things were anywhere.
Were there many underage soldiers?
I would think there would be. But when they come to us as soldiers, we don't ask their age. Although we think sometimes, because that was, 20, 21s, because they weren't being called up in them days till they were 21. It was only later, well, round about there, they did it a little bit, because they needed soldiers out there. And I suppose young lads, teenagers, could get away with a couple of years. But there again, the ITCs, wherever they were trained, should have nobbled down to this, that they were underage. And so, it wasn't a question when they came to us. They'd done the basic training. It wasn't a question of us asking ages.
Just wasn't something you thought about?
No.
What about the padre and, the chaplain? Did you see much of them, or were they any good? Or?
Oh, yes, we saw a lot of the chaplain, for the padre. They were all up the line, and they had it. I suppose, although it was the job, I suppose it would be a terrible job. Some of the people, that were blown apart and that, and they had to see them buried. They had an awful job. And one thing about the padre, it doesn't matter whether it was a C or B or an RC, this was one place where you found that he made friends with everybody, irrespective of what religion. As I said earlier on, the RC, when I first joined the army, the RC padre came into my billet room, and all he spoke to was the RCs. The C of E padre came in the next day and he spoke to everybody. But in a battalion, he spoke to everybody, irrespective. And they were great men. So was the MOs. We lost one on D-Day. Severely wounded. We got another one, and there were a different class of people being doctors. They accepted everybody. They talked to you if you'd been wounded, slightly wounded. They would talk to you whether you should go back or go back into the line. They were very sympathetic to you. Oh, great.
Did you need any help from them during the campaign to get through, because you'd got your weakened leg?
No. See, my leg, as long as I was going under my own steam, it didn't affect us. The only time it affected us was if I was doing strenuous. See, my legs, both legs, used to swell during the day. And if I rested them, they would go back. They still do today. They still swell. But if you rest them and get your feet up, supposing it's only for 5 minutes, they go back to normal. I never bothered about it. The only thing I think that would have bothered me if, although there again, I fired the brain gun off my shoulder. My shoulder was my biggest worry. I didn't tackle a paint gun because I knew it would have busted my shoulder if I didn't get it right. But a brain gun, a rifle, it was very reluctant to fire off me. But once I had to do it, it didn't bother me anymore.
What about the colour sergeants and the quartermaster's staff? Did they do a good job during the campaign?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, they had a hard task. They were always back by, but they used to come into the line every day, sometimes twice a day. It just depends where you were. They used to come tea and packets of biscuits, bully beef for your lunch. And then night time they used to come again with tea, hot meals, and they did a great job. Anything you needed, you told them in the morning and it came up at night time.
What about the battalion military police, or even the army military police? How did you get on with them? Or did you see much of them?
I never saw much of them. The regimental police, yes. They had a job gathering the prisoners and escorting them. They didn't bother us much. The only time they bothered us was when you were back by, and unless you were asking for it, they never bothered us much. And I can't say that I had a lot of trouble with the CMPs. The Red Caps, you saw them. You were wary of them. Again, you were asking for trouble. If you did anything, you knew if there was a Red Cap near you, you know, you were for the hide them. But more or less, they realised that you were relaxing, and people do funny things when they relax.
So they were reasonable enough?
Oh, they were reasonable. You got the odd men. Same as you did in the battalion, that still went by them. If you broke a rule, they nailed you, but they were far and few between.
What about the support you had from the RAF in the campaign? Were you satisfied with that compared to 40?
From D-Day, yes. Before D-Day, from up the desert and that, the RAF, we did the job that you wanted them to do. Sometimes made a mistake. The Americans made a lot of mistakes, the Americans Air Force. They used to do this pattern bombing from a great height during the day. And sometimes they nailed us. It was just one of those, you accepted it just as one of those things. But the Dunkirk days, them days.
We discussed that, yeah. Mm. So the RAF gave you the support you needed?
Well, yes. From D-Day, yes. If you wanted anything, if you were held up with anything and it was too big to handle, you called the RAF and they came and sorted it out with the typhoons and mosquitoes. They did a great job from D-Day.
Do you remember any of the battalion, just really general, any of the battalion characters that we haven't actually mentioned yet?
Well, there was a lot of characters in their own little way. Johnny Franklin.
Who was he?
He was a dispatch rider. And he always had two candles hanging out of his nose. And
why?
I don't know. So I don't know whether it was the wind or what, riding the bike. And We used to call him Candlestick. See, lots of people had little characteristics about them. I can't think of anybody.
Do you remember the cook?
Who called the cook? We had some good ones, we had some bad ones. We had one used to make us dumplings, and you bow-legged after you'd had the dumplings. He was a great character as well, Cutty. He was well known by everybody in the battalion.
What kind of a man was he?
Oh, he was great, a great man. If you wanted anything, Cutty was the man to get it. There were quite a few people like that. Didn't matter what you wanted, you just had to send word to him and he would get referring back to the provost staff. We had a provost sergeant who was a character in himself, but he was also a bully. He'd thump you as soon as look at you.
What was his name?
Burn up, as a matter of fact. And the boys used to do some strange tricks to him, mind, to get their own back.
Such as?
Well, as I say, we used to send the prisoners back to him, to the provost staff. And he used to search them for weapons, money, watches, anything. And he had quite a stack of money in the kit bag. And he'd done something to some of the lads. And when he went for his kit bag, the kit bag had gone. So they got their own back by taking the kit bag. But money, we had our own money. You know, this British, what was it they call it? I can't think of the name now, what it was called. But we had our own coinage. And unless you bank, their money was no good to you. I suppose if you got it back to England and took it to the bank, you would get it changed, but to what value, I don't know. Quite a lot of...
Walbanks wasn't in your company, was he?
No, he wasn't in my company. And the only time I used to be in contact with Walbanks was where we had a sans... You know, when we came out, if we had a sans mess, that's the only time. He was... funny sort of a fella. He wasn't very well liked.
Why not?
Well, I'm talking about his own company. What he did out of action, I don't know. See, as I said earlier on, and you had five families in one big family, and thinking back about, I think an officer, a new officer coming, at first he wasn't accepted by the family, and I think this is why you had to get to know them before you accept into the family. It was like a lot of recruits when their face come. You always had the odd man that knew the book more than you did, had more experience than you. The tough guy who wasn't long before he got cut down to size, but when they... And he was, you know, sort of isolated till he proved what he was shouting about he could do. And this was it. I mean, there's any amount of the 8th Battalion. Although I was in the 8th Battalion from France BF days right through to being demobbed. There was men that had gone through the 8th Battalion that I only knew them by sight, never knew them by name. Because in wartime, you're never all together in one spot. I don't think it was till the days in Harrogate where we were all in one barracks together. You were always detached. So you were away from other people. And you were always getting recruits, so you never got to know recruits in another company. You only knew the people, the old boys, or somebody that did something out of the ordinary, and you got to know them.
So, we're now at Keighley, mm-hmm. in Yorkshire. What happened there?
Well, we arrived back in Keighley, and we were made up to strength in NCOs. They came from the artillery searchlights. We had to first train them into the ways of an infantryman. And then we got the recruits coming in. Now, the recruits, they differed in so much as some were coming from ITCs after the basic training. The others were odds and sods out of such as artillery, ACAC, searchlights, anything that could spare any men to made into infantrymen ready for the Germany, because this was November time, but we landed back in November, and we were preparing these people for reinforcements for the push into Germany. And basically we trained them in field craft, formations, attacks, defence, and we used to take them on, we used to go down to or Newcastle and take them down in street fighting. defusing booby traps and such as that. And then they used to be sent to a holding battalion and went to France, to Europe.
How did you settle into being back into almost peacetime soldiering, so to speak, a training role, rather than that you'd been a...
It took a long while to settle down into the routine again of being an instructor in peacetime, in peacetime surroundings.
What were the difficulties of settling down? What did you find?
Well, I couldn't put my finger on it, but... I suppose you missed the shot and the shell, and
could you settle back to having to be smart all the time and that sort
of
thing?
Yes,
that was no trouble.
That was no trouble. That that was no trouble. That, and then in the May, I think it was the May. I went to the palace for the investiture. All the lads that had won decorations, and I arrived in London the night before I went to the palace with my wife and my father, and we were back in the firing line with these doodle bugs. And we caught a bus on the morning. I had to be at the palace for 10 o'clock. And we caught a bus to take us to the palace, and there was a doodle bug came over not far from the route we were on and landed, and it caused quite a bit of chaos. And I was lucky to get to the palace. But I arrived there safe and sound anyhow.
What do you remember of the investiture?
Well, we went into the palace, and my wife and my father was taken away from me and shown into the auditorium, as you call it. And we were taken into a room, and in this part of the palace there's quite a few of these rooms, and depending on the decoration you were going to receive, which room you went, and the investiture was going to start at 10:30. And I found myself third on the list. And this manservant, or whoever he was, came into this room, lined us all up in our places, and told us that we had to forget we were on the barrack square. When your name was called, you walked up to the king, no stamping of feet, turned to him, gripped his hand, shook once, left go. And as I say, I was third on turn. The two boys in front of me were two twin brothers. They both had been awarded the DFC. And when my turn came, I went up, and the king asked me where I'd been awarded the DCM. And I told him at Geel in Belgium. And he talked to me about the battle, which rather surprised me, because there was about 250 people there for decorations, and that he could pick and tell me what went on at Geel. And I came down from the dais, and you were escorted straight out into the palace yard, and the pressmen were there taking your photos. And I said to these two twin brothers, I wonder how long this is going to take. So they said, come with me, come with us, and we'll come back about 3 o'clock. So we went out of the palace into a pub, the Bag of Nails, I think they call it, round the side of Buckingham Palace. And we were in there, and I came out at half past two, and sauntered back to the gates, and just after being out 5 minutes, the congregation came out, and they'd been sitting from 10:30 till about 2:45, weren't allowed to move. And my wife said to me, when your name was called out and you went up to the king, your father stood up. And a beef eater hit him on top of the head and told him to sit down. So he came out and came back to Keithley.